Yes, you can hear. Okay, so I'll try and keep. As you can see, I came back from India with a bad flu or cold. So you'll have to be nice to me today. This is work I'm going to report on has been done, developed a sort of point of view towards quantum mechanics and a attempted reformulation of a realistic nature that's been done over the years with many people. Some of the names are here, some of them associated with Perimeter. Let me introduce it by posing a more general question than the one in the title, which to me is the question that everyone engaged in thinking about quantum foundations is trying to answer, or at least from my point of view, it's the question that I would like to answer from my work and other people's work in quantum foundations. And there are many reasons for asking it such a question. What is the to what physical reality does the quantum formalism refer? But in my case, I suppose the strongest one has to do with quantum gravity and with the need to be able to think about the microscopic world at a Planck scale or the early universe in a way that doesn't involve, in an essential way, the notion of observer and external agent. Of course, there are philosophical reasons for thinking, for wanting to do away with those things as well, which are, I think, also important. But the most important practical one for me is quantum gravity. And that certainly colors the kind of answer that I will be suggesting. I will be proposing it. Can you see this cursor here?
Yeah.
So the answer that I will be proposing, and which I've spoken on before here, comes from thinking of quantum mechanics as a theory of histories. When I say history, a theory of history is based on the path integral. So when I say history, I mean exactly what is meant in the phrase sum over histories by that word. So for example, when we'll come to the actual example that I'll be doing, which will be a particle hopping on a lattice, a history will just be a trajectory of that particle, if you like, a world line. The reason for thinking of, as I said, this approach comes from thinking, trying to think of reality in terms of histories, and the motivation for doing that is, again, from quantum gravity, to me the strongest motivation, which is the other ways of approaching quantum gravity seem to me not to be able to do it justice. That's another whole story. But many of us have been convinced for a while that it's among the known formulations of quantum mechanics, it's only the sum over histories that is compatible with the needs of quantum gravity or the needs of gravity. So this formulation comes not only from histories, trying to make what I might call a histories-based interpretation or reformulation of quantum mechanics. I say reformulation because what one needs is a way of talking about quantum mechanics without ever introducing anything but histories. That is what you might call a sort of freestanding path integral formulation of quantum mechanics. But this proposal that I make for answering the question, what is a quantum reality, also comes from putting aside for the moment, questions of probability in order to grapple first with what you might call the logical paradoxes of quantum mechanics. The idea being that the logic is more fundamental than probability, and if we can address those kind of questions, then probability will be the next step. So it's not that probability was totally being set aside here, but only a little bit is being kept of it, namely the notion of probability zero. But when I talk about the logical paradoxes of quantum mechanics, I'm talking about the things that are not like the Bell inequalities, which involve probabilities, but the things that are like the Kochensprecher paradox. The Kochensprecher paradox, and then very closely related paradoxes that have to do with the issue of local causality. So that's, first of all, the Kochensprecher, a version of Kochensprecher due to Alan Stairs. Second of all, probably GHZ, and third of all, Hardy's paradox. All of these are kinds of paradoxes that are logical in nature in the sense that something is incompatible with the classical notion of reality in quantum mechanics, even without worrying about correlations and things of a probabilistic nature. These that I just named involve local causality, or the idea of relativistic causality, but there are also simpler paradoxes like the three slit paradox, which also has the name of sometimes the three boxes paradox. And even the Kochensprecher paradox in its original form, where it doesn't involve two coupled systems, which is the form in which Alan Stairs put it. So the point is, there are a bunch of situations in which it's not possible to think of reality, as I now think anyway, as I now accept, it's not possible to think of reality as a single history of the classical nature. For a while I thought it was, but I've been convinced that that in the end will not work. So we have to put something, precisely because of these logical paradoxes, so we have to put something in its place. And what is, according to this proposal, what's in its place is is not that different from history. It's something that you might regard as a generalization of the notion of history, whose technical description is given by what we call an anhomomorphic coevent, which I'll explain in a bit what that means. The important thing is coevent, which is basically a catalog, if you like, or a truth function that tells you which events happens and which don't. So this proposal I'm going to illustrate in the talk in the context of a very simple toy universe, simple as possible, just a particle hopping on a lattice. So there's nothing in the world other than that. And I'll present an elementary calculation that I hope can indicate how the proposal is meant to go more generally. That is, I'm not going to try and give general definitions, but I hope that the basic idea will come through from the calculation. Because we'll be working with histories, or because such an approach works with histories, trajectories, if you like, and not with wave functions, concepts like a position at a given time will have a straightforward meaning, but concepts like energy and momentum will not, because normally we refer them to the wave function. So we then have to ask, for example, for thinking of a hydrogen atom, how does an electron in a hydrogen atom, how can it know when it's in its ground state, or perhaps it's in some excited state, other stationary state, or of course some non-stationary state, but let's limit ourselves to these two cases. Is there something about its trajectory that carries this information, just as it would be the case classically, where of course if you could follow the trajectory of an electron in a classical hydrogen atom, you of course would know its energy. So that's what the title of this talk refers to, and that's the thing I'm going to concentrate on in this calculation.
So they say the general rule that if there's a question mark in the title, the answer is no. So is that satisfied here?
I think that I've heard that said, but I think it's historically false. A good example is, does the inertia of a body depend on its energy content? If you remember that, that was some paper. I think that was the paper where E equals mc squared was proposed. So maybe this can be in that tradition and not in the one that you have in mind. Oh, the answer was yes. The answer is going to be yes.
Okay.
In this model, the answer will be yes. I see. So we have both, yeah.
Yeah. I guess it's not a general rule.
It's not a general rule. I mean, if you would ask this in the context of Bohmian mechanics, for example, the answer would be the other way around. In the ground state, because the wave function is real, its phase doesn't change with location, and so in the ground state of a Bohmian particle, at least in something as simple as a hydrogen atom, it'll just sit still, not moving at all. And so therefore, by knowing the trajectory, you would not know the energy. Of course, in the Bohmian theory, you're supposed to think, or many people think of the wave function as also real, and it's carrying the information on the entropy. So let me, I'll come back and say a little bit more about what I mean by a coevent and so on. But before doing that, let me describe the model in which we'll be doing this calculation. This is what you might call, it's a little more general. I mean, what we'll be doing is a special case of this where n equals 3. But this is a model of a particle propagating on a circular lattice with n lattice points in which time, so Zn here, in which both time and space are discrete. So it's like a quantum version of a random walk, if you like, in the sense that there's just discrete moments of time, and at each moment, it hops or doesn't hop from one lattice point to another lattice point. It's a unitary, it's kind of, I think this is kind of interesting in itself and is worthy of more study because it's a strictly unitary model, and naively, in the continuum limit, it goes over to the relativistic free particle. So it would be interesting to prove or to study, decide whether or not this is actually true of the propagator that you would produce. In other words, the product of the what you might call the transfer matrix over many time steps. Anyway, the transfer matrix is, as I said, a discrete analog of a non-relativistic free particle. And you can see that here. So it's defined just by giving the amplitude to hop in one time step from some location x in the lattice to some location x prime. And it's given by a very simple formula, which depends on whether the total number of lattice points is even or odd, but has essentially the same form in both cases. To write it down, I've made a definition here that this 1, this bold-faced 1, is just e to the 2 pi I. So you can read this, for example, as e to the 2 pi I x minus x prime squared over n. Or you can read this by saying 1 to the 1 over n means an nth root of unity, and then it's that nth root of unity raised to the power x minus x prime squared. So to those who are familiar with the form of the propagator for a non-relativistic path integral, you'll easily recognize this as having that same form, which is also, if you get rid of the I and change it to a minus sign, is the form, of course, of it's the Gaussian spreading of a diffusing particle in one dimension. It's not entirely obvious, but one can check that this gives a unitary matrix for all n. Two cases are of special interest. Two special cases are simpler than the others, which is that n equals 2 and n equals 3. We'll be looking at n equals 3. N equals 2 you might just recognize as the amplitudes for reflecting off a half-silvered mirror or something like that. N equals 3 is the one we'll be looking at. And it has a very simple form in which all the amplitudes are either 1 or omega, where omega is this cube root of unity. So it means that, so in this case we'll be looking at will just be 3 lattice points. And it'll mean the amplitude to hop to the neighboring point, every other lattice node is a neighbor, is just given by omega, which is sort of the cube root of unity. And the amplitude to stay put is 1 up to a normalization, which I won't bother with, of 1 over cube root of 3. So that's the model we'll be working with. And in fact, we'll only let it run for 3 time steps, which is the simplest non-trivial case. Well, 2 time steps is non-trivial also, but it doesn't illustrate the result that I'm claiming as well. Yeah.
So when you say transfer matrix, is that the same as propagator? Or?
Yeah, you could say it. Yeah, I don't know the. More precisely what it is. I mean, another word for it, it's the transition amplitude. So the amplitude for a path. I mean, I'll give some examples explicitly of paths and their amplitudes, but the amplitude for a path, as it always in the path integral, will be some initial amplitude, sort of the amplitude, here look in the case of 2 maybe, some initial amplitude with which it starts off at a given point, times the product of all the amplitudes associated with the different steps. So this matrix is just the matrix of those amplitudes. So let me now talk about the scheme more generally, which we're going to examine in this example, which is, as I said, we call the name of coevent. And within that, something called the multiplicative scheme, which is an abbreviated MSK, multiplicative scheme. So as I've said, in this kind of formulation, histories and not the wave function are fundamental. Physical reality is some sort of generalized history, and it's described by a coevent, which we'll call phi. A coevent is no more than a map that from events to 0 and 1, which tells you which events happen and which don't. Now, what do I mean by event? By event, I mean a set of histories. This is the same as the usage in probability theory in stochastic processes. And if you think about it, it corresponds to the everyday meaning of the word event pretty well. So don't think that event means like point of space-time. That's a different usage, although you might regard it as a special case in some way. But just event means a set of histories. Of course, quantum mechanics doesn't give us, in most interpretations, and most of us would not expect any theory to give us the only possible world, the world as it actually is in all its detail. So when I say a physical reality, of course, I don't necessarily mean the physical reality. I just mean some possible physical reality. Just as classical mechanics doesn't tell us exactly what the world is, but it gives us a range of possibilities which we can parameterize by initial conditions in that case because it's deterministic. And a stochastic process like a Brownian motion gives us a range of possible realities again, each of which is again, like in the classical world, a single trajectory. So here we again have a notion of a possible reality. And the function of the theory, of the dynamical part of the theory, is to tell us which realities are possible and which are not dynamically. So one can think of the theory as having a kinematic part, which describes what is a history, what is the kind of thing we're talking about. In this case, it's a trajectory, and a dynamic part, which tells you which generalized trajectories actually are possible. As I said, a generalized trajectory, in the sense I'm using it, will be described by just telling which events happen and which do not. If you think about it, that's all you could ever ask, because every question that you can ask, arguably, about the world is a question of whether a certain event has happened or will happen. And if you have the answers to those, then you have a complete description of that world. Now, as I said, the dynamics I haven't yet told you where these coevents come from exactly, but the dynamics is meant to take the form of a path integral, or in this case, a path sum. The wave function, insofar as it enters at all, enters only as an initial condition, which one should think of as an approximate summary of the past. Ideally, this is a side comment, but ideally, you would probably want to go back to the very beginning of the universe, if there is, and just have boundary conditions on that beginning. That's obviously too cumbersome for doing everyday quantum mechanics. So you introduce a wave function to get things started. So when you talk about amplitude of a certain trajectory, it's made up, as I just said, of a product of terms. Each term, each factor is one of the transition amplitudes. And then, but there's an initial amplitude to have started at a given place, as if the particle was released at a given location or created at a given location. That's how wave function enters, as an initial condition. But once it gets things started, you never refer to it again. So that's the sense in which I'm talking about the path integral. But one can then ask, what does it compute? So a traditional answer might be, if you open up any chapter, any textbook and any chapter on quantum mechanics and the path integral, it might tell you that it computes a propagator or a transition probability from one state to another via sum over paths. However, if that were all it did, then it was just telling, it's just a clever way of solving the Schrodinger equation, and you would be back at the interpretive level of thinking about the wave function. We don't want to do that. We don't want to do that, as I said. So we have to think slightly differently about what the path integral computes. And the answer I would give is that it computes the quantum measure, mu of A, of any event. So given any set of histories, it gives you a non-negative real number associated with that set of histories, which is basically the sum of their amplitudes squared. For those who know the word decoherence functional, it's used in the decoherent histories approach, this quantum measure mu of A is sometimes referred to as the diagonal element of the decoherence functional. So what is this mu of A? Well, for a unitary system, it's produced in the following way. Given any set of histories, so that's a set of trajectories in this example, you start with the initial wave function, you propagate it forward via the path integral, but summing only those histories in the event A, the set of histories A, that gives you a final wave function depending on A, and you take its norm squared. That's the quantum measure. Now, although we don't think about it normally in that way, I claim, and we could discuss it later if you're not convinced, that all the Born rule probabilities are just of the form mu of A for some event A, where A is a what you might call an instrument event. So, in that way, this measure contains all of everyday, the rule of thumb that we use when we use the Born rule is completely captured by this mu of A. And you never, in order to do quantum mechanics in the way it's normally done, you never need to go beyond this mu. So that's the thing I'm trying to stress. It contains, you don't have to talk about collapse of wave function and so on. You just need to compute the measures of these events. But the events have, in general, to include reference to the measuring apparatus.
So, quick question. So you said that the complex description of the universe is to specify what events are possible and what events are not possible, right?
Not possible. Which actually happen and which actually don't happen.
I see.
So possible is coming next, right? So what...
the one that the description you have. So what was the definition of a coevent?
I'll leave it aside for a second. So a coevent is if you think of an event as a question, like does this happen or does this not happen, the co-event is this complete set of answers to all those questions. So if we were to introduce a set of all events, which turns out to be a Boolean algebra, and map it into Z2, that would be the co-event. Z, this is plus 1 being true or happens, and 0 being false or doesn't happen. Right? So that's the co-event. But I'll show in a second what it means in practice in this case. Yeah.
But so an event is a collection of histories.
An event is a set of histories.
So classically, would we say only one of these things happens?
No. So classically, what would happen classically? Classically, there would be. Let me jump ahead to this picture for a second. So. Think of this as the space of all histories, this screen here, okay, this screen here. And an event would be something like a set of histories. Classically, reality would be described by a single point somewhere in this space because just one history happens. And then those events which contain that history also happen, and those events which exclude that history, say the history was here, say inside F here somewhere, then those events, would, like in C, is another event that doesn't contain that magic history, which is the real, represents reality. They don't happen. So I claim this is, I mean, this is the usage in probability theory, but I claim it's also the everyday usage. So I like to talk about rain, for example. So suppose we had a theory of weather, and that was trajectories of molecule, of water molecules or something, and then we want to know, is it raining? So, well, there's a set of world lines for which the water molecules are now falling on Waterloo. And there's another set of histories in which the molecules are somewhere else and not falling. So given any one of those as the reality, you can ask whether or not it's raining. And that's whether it's raining is a property of that history. And then what we're calling the event of rain is the set of all the histories that have that property that it is raining. Okay, so that's.
So it's the intersection of all histories in which that event occurs?
No, maybe I should have specified. When I say history, I mean just a single fine-grained history, so just a single trajectory. So it's the opposite. It's the union. Or maybe you meant to say union, not intersection. The history would be, the single history which represents reality, classically, would be the intersection of all the events that happen in that world. Okay, I mean, because if you have a single history, and here's an event that happens, here's another event that happens, here's another event that happens, here's an event that doesn't happen, because it doesn't contain that history. So if you take the intersection of all of these, obviously you're going to get back down to the original history itself.
So I can think of events as coarse-grained representations and the intersection of all the events.
Yes, you could think of an event as a coarse-grained history, precisely. Yeah.
So are you insisting that the intersection of all the events is it like a singleton, like a single history? Or
classically.
Classically, but not.
Not quantum. So in fact, that'll be the difference. The difference in this multiplicative scheme will be precisely that the intersection of all the events that happen is a finite set of history, you know, a non-singleton set of histories. Where do we go? Yeah. So what will determine what this set will be? So here comes another basic notion, which is preclusions. Remember I said we're going to concentrate on the logical aspects of the question of foundations. And preclusion is meant to be the idea that in a given event cannot happen. It cannot happen. Why? Because its measure is zero. So I very quickly described to you how to define this quantum measure in the case of a unitary dynamics. And I told you that when you're dealing with instrument events, mu, according to the Born rule, gives the probability. But when you're dealing with events that are microscopic events or not instrument events, mu doesn't directly have the interpretation of a probability. And it cannot because of interference. However, what we're going to do, what I'm proposing to do here, is to carry over one aspect of probability, which is that if mu is zero, then that event cannot happen. Here I'm saying it's hard to imagine anything else. If you're going to give mu any direct meaning at all, it's hard to imagine that it doesn't mean this preclusion. But this has to do with philosophy of probability and raises a whole bunch of questions. But that's going to be the assumption, that an event of measure zero does not happen. That is basically an event where all the histories that make it up mutually destructively interfere. We'll say that event doesn't happen. Now, this partly determines the co-event, because it tells us that the co-event must annihilate certain events, those, namely those which have zero measure. But if it's far from determining the co-event, of course, as I said, we don't hope to determine the co-event fully, which would be to give a complete theory of everything in all its details. But certainly we need more than just this one fact, because even classically, this one fact would allow a whole bunch of co-events, and it wouldn't drive us towards the fact that reality is to be represented by a single history. So we need to further limit the possible co-events, and the key concept here is that we ask them to be minimal in a certain sense, which I'll call primitive. Now, so far I claim once you start with the path integral, everything, you're sort of just following your nose. It may not have been completely convincing to you here, but if you think about it, I think that all these ideas, including preclusion, arise very naturally and hard to avoid. However, the exact definition of primitivity is much more of an open question. And what I'm going to propose to you here now is just the simplest answer that it can be given. And one which, suitably phrased, coincides precisely with the corresponding classical criterion. I'm going to say it in a sentence, but if it doesn't mean anything to you, forget it, and I'll illustrate in this picture here what that means. The sentence that one can say is that for any given co-event, the set of events which happen form a maximal preclusive filter, where preclusive means that we don't, that the among the events which do happen, none of them are precluded. I claim that if you say those words, if you sort of intone those words and apply them to the classical situation where there is no interference, you'll be led right back to the idea that reality is represented by a single history. If you intone the same words in the quantum case where you have interference and non-classical patterns of preclusion, then you'll be led to this, what I'm about to tell you now. Maybe it would be worth just saying one other thing before we go on to the actual examples, which is all these paradoxes that I referred to in the beginning can be thought of in terms of preclusion. What they tell you is that, for example, what the Cochran-Specker paradox tells you is that the set of all histories, the space of all histories whatsoever, is covered by precluded events. In other words, you can find subsets of measure zero such that every history belongs to one of those. And in some sense, therefore, nothing can happen. Nothing could happen if you were in a classical world. That's what I mean by a non-classical pattern of preclusion. I mean, that's an extreme example of a non-classical pattern of preclusion. Okay, so here's the proposal. A co-event is determined not by a single history. Remember, a co-event is a possible reality. It's determined not by a single history, but by a set of histories, which I'll call the support. And in that case, I'll write that phi, the co-event, is F star. This set of histories determines for every event whether it happens or not, according to the rule stated here. An event happens if and only if it contains that set of histories, that's an obvious generalization of the fact that classically it happens if and only if it contains the one history that represents reality. Now, what then is a primitive co-event? First of all, it must be consistent with the preclusions, what I called preclusive. So here's a picture of the F, which is the corresponds to the reality in this case. It's a set of histories, F. And consider the three events, A, B, and C. In this, if this represented the world, this particular F, then the event A happens. The event C does not happen because it doesn't contain F. And furthermore, the event B, although it intersects F, doesn't contain it. And so it also doesn't happen. So the rule, the proposal, or the essence of this scheme is that a primitive history must be consistent with the preclusions. It must not be inside any precluded event. Sorry. So example, in this example, A better not be a precluded event, although B and C could be precluded, that is of measure zero. But given that condition, it must be as small as possible or minimal consistent with that. So it shouldn't have any superfluous histories in it in order to be satisfy this preclusion. That's the definition. If we review where it came from, the basic concepts here were events, co-events, preclusion, and primitivity. I've just defined for you primitivity. I could now say more about this scheme in general and about its consequences, for example, its consequences for the measurement problem. Another very interesting thing is a kind of radical inseparability that it seems to bring about, so that given any two subsystems, quote unquote, which in the normal sense of the word are not interacting and not even correlated, you will find that in the fine structure of reality, there are very many strong correlations between those subsystems. That also follows from this. But for the rest of this talk, I just want to concentrate on the one part of the one question that I raised before. Does the particle know its own energy? So now let's go back to the particular Let's go back to the particular example. So as I said, we're going to consider the case n equals 3 of this n-site hopper, which is a particle hopping on a lattice of 3 points. And we're going to let time run for 3 steps. So it's going to start at t equals 0 at one of these locations. And the amplitude for which it will start at one of these locations is given by this initial wave function, which will determine whether it's in the ground state or some excited state or whatever. The amplitude, so that I'll consider two cases. One is that of what you might call the ground state, where the amplitudes are all equal along this for each starting location. And the other one you might regard as a kind of traveling wave in which roughly speaking, it's like an angular momentum eigenstate in which it's the amplitudes are eigenstate of the rotation operator, given then by 1 omega and omega squared. Since that's the less trivial one, it's the one that I've illustrated here. Now it follows, I haven't proved this to you, but it follows from the definitions I just gave that for any primitive co-event, any that has any possible reality, the particle will have a definite ending, a definite location at the end. This is kind of what you might call a record, and it's actually closely related. I mean, it plays an important role in one way of thinking about the measurement problem, but it's just it's a theorem that one can prove. So since I had 3 starting points and then 3 steps, 3 possible steps, I would have 3 times 3 times 3 times 3, whatever that is, 81 possible histories. But since I can limit myself by this theorem to one definite ending location, I'll just take that to be the upper vertex, and then we'll have only 27 histories to think about. So we'll limit ourselves to the case that x equals 1 at t equals 3. There are then these 27 histories, and for each one we can compute its amplitude. So let me illustrate this one, for example. This very first one, this is meant to indicate that the particle begins at the vertex and never goes anywhere. So its amplitude is then 1 to get started, and then 1, you know, not to go anywhere each step. So its overall amplitude is 1. On the other hand, the second one starts down here, lower right, where the amplitude was omega squared. It takes 1 step, which has an amplitude of omega. So its net amplitude is omega squared times omega, which is omega cubed, which is 1. So it also has amplitude 1. This actually represents 3 possible histories, because it could have hopped. It had to hop exactly once, and it could have been the first time, the second time, or the third time, and so on. Here's another example of a history where it hops on each possible step. It starts lower right, goes lower left, back to lower right, and back to the top, and so on. That happens if you work it out as an amplitude omega bar. So you can compute all these 27 amplitudes. And once you have them, now we can find the primitive coevents. Because the rule I gave makes the primitive coevents only depend on what histories are available and what their amplitudes are. So in this case, if you go back to this and count up the different amplitudes, you can see that the amplitude omega bar occurs 3 times here, 3 times here, once here, once on. If you add them all up, you'll see that the amplitude omega bar, which is omega squared, bar meaning complex conjugate, occurs 12 times. 12 histories have this amplitude. 9 of them have the amplitude 1, and 6 of them have the amplitude omega. Now remember the rule: for primitive coevent must be given by a set of histories which is not contained in any precluded set of histories, any precluded event, and is as small as possible subject to that condition. So what does that say? Well, first, so to work out what those are, we need to know what are the precluded events. A precluded event would be, in this case, a set of histories whose, since they all end at the same point, it's enough to add up their amplitudes and square to get their measure. So it'd be a set of histories such that the amplitudes add up to 0. So which of these amplitudes add up to 0? Well, the only relations among the 3 cube roots of unity are that they sum to 0. So to get a precluded event, we need one history with amplitude 1, one history with amplitude omega, and one history with amplitude omega bar. It's clear that we can get 6 such sets this way, because there are 6 of these omegas and more than 6 of the others. We can get 6 and no more than 6. So any set of histories that contains 6 or fewer copies of a single amplitude, of each amplitude, will be contained in a precluded event, because I can just add in more histories to make it be 6, 6, and 6. So none of those yield possible supports of primitive coevents. However, if the set of histories has at least 7 histories with amplitude omega bar, or 7 with amplitude 1, then there's no way of supplementing it with other histories to give 0. And therefore, it will be preclusive. It will satisfy the condition that it does not affirm any precluded event, does not say that any precluded event happens. So how many are there? So we get the possible realities of the possible coevents by selecting 7 histories with amplitude 1 or 7 histories with amplitude omega bar. Of course, you could have larger sets, but they're not primitive, because you can always cut them down to what I said, and it remains preclusive. So with the first type, 7 copies, histories with amplitude 1, how many are there? There's 9 such histories, 9 choose 7, or 36. With omega bar, 7 copies. You have 12 choose 7, 12 here, 12 to 7 for 792, for a total of 828 primitive coevents altogether. This is for that particular initial state. So for example, here's just one of the 828. It's a set, they all have a set of seven histories. This one consists of entirely of histories which move when they move in a positive direction, counterclockwise direction. So it starts in the lower right, moves to the top, starts in the lower left, moves around to the top, or starts in the top and moves all the way back to the top. Those are seven histories. They all have amplitude one, I believe. And they define a possible reality. Notice that this coevent has a net circulation of, if we sort of count the number of times it moves positively minus negatively, it has a net circulation of 3 here, 3 times 2 here, and 3 here again for 12. So it's interesting that for all the coevents, the 828, the net circulation is positive. The average net circulation is positive. It turns out to be 7/23. So it's a kind of hint that the particle is doing what you would have expected for an angular momentum state of a positive sort. Now we have to redo the same exercise for the coevents, for the initial state being the ground, so-called ground state, where the amplitudes are equal. We compute the amplitudes the same way. The set of paths are the same, but now we have different amplitude assignments because the initial amplitudes are different. So we go back to the same set of histories. But now this one, for example, the second one here, instead of having an amplitude 1, we'll now just have an amplitude omega because it started with the amplitude 1 and then hopped once for an amplitude omega. So the amplitudes are shuffled among themselves, but by some coincidence, it turns out, I don't know why this should have happened, but it just so happened that you get the same set of amplitudes just distributed differently among the histories. So again, to compute the coevents, we only needed to know the amplitudes, and so we get, again, 828 coevents. So before answering the question, the main question, which is, does the particle know its energy, let me ask another question which is of interest here, which I've asked, how peripatetic is the ground state particle? I've asked this as a sort of contrast with the Bohmian case. Remember I mentioned that according to the Bohm theory, a particle that starts, that's in its ground state, doesn't move at all. So we could ask the same question here. Does the particle move when the initial amplitudes are those of the ground state? Well, we could also ask the opposite. What does it mean? Walking around a lot or something like that? Walking. Something like this. What? This question can be translated, how much does the particle tend to move around in its ground state? So the extreme case would be that the particle never rests, but I mean, there's two extreme cases, one where the history where it just stays put and doesn't do anything, and the other history is in which it's always moving. So this, for example, is a history where it's always moving. This is a history where it never moves. This is a history where it moves part of the time and stays put part of the time. So if the coevent, the support of the coevent, is made up entirely of histories that never rest, then we can say that the particle always moves, that the event that the particle always moves happens in that world described by that coevent. It turns out that there are eight such coevents. So if the world was described by one of those, it would be correct to say that the particle is never at rest. If we now look at, those are only 8 of the 828. If we look at the others, there are 28 in which the hopper, in which it never rests or never moves. That is, it's made of 6 paths that don't rest at all and 1 path that stays put entirely. And then 792 co-events where on 2 occasions it hops and on the 3rd occasion it doesn't hop. In any case, the event that the particle doesn't move at all does not happen. For no matter which co-event you choose, it denies that the particle is at rest. Because the particle at rest would just correspond to one single history. That event is just a singleton. And none of the co-events have a support within that singleton. They all have 7 histories in their support. Okay, so let's get to the... I guess this is the, no, next to last. Oops, next to last. So let's get to the question I started with. Does it know its energy? What does that mean? Of course, we're not going to make a theory of the particle's knowledge. All we mean is if we could somehow magically observe the particle in such a way as to know the full reality, the full co-event, would we be able to tell from looking at that whether or not we had put in as an initial state psi zero or psi plus, the ground state or the excited state? Well, that's just a question of, does, from the knowing the co-event, can you deduce the ground, which state you're in? That's true if and only if there are no overlaps, in other words, that no co-event belongs both to the ground state and the excited state. In this case, it turns out that there are 828 co-events in each case, as we saw. And I won't prove that. It turns out that no co-event is common to both of those two cases. So from that point of view, so knowing the co-event fully determines knowing the energy. Here I'm assuming that psi is a stationary state so that energy has meaning. Then we can limit ourselves to those two states. And strictly speaking, there's another one, which is like a standing wave. I haven't worked out the answer for that. It might be interesting to do. But I would expect something similar. But at least for these two stationary states, the co-event fully determines which one you started with. So from that point of view, we could say that the particle does know its own energy. Moreover, aside from just listing the 828 here and the 828 here and looking for overlaps, there are very simple attributes or events that you can distinguish between the two cases. If you like, properties of the histories that can distinguish. Properties of the generalized history, I should say, that can distinguish between the two cases. If the particle never rests, we saw that that was the case for some co-event that belonged to the ground state. If you have a co-event that affirms that the particle never rests, then actually you're in the ground state, perhaps a bit counterintuitively. Another example is if the particle moves only counterclockwise in a positive direction, so that's like saying, that is saying that the support is made up entirely of histories that move in a positive direction when they move, then, and this is intuitive, then the state must be in the excited state. And then just as another example, which is neither intuitive, neither here nor there, I think, but is correct, if the particle rests exactly once, then it must be the excited state. So if you could make enough lists of events like this, and if you got the answers to all of those from the given co-event, you would know whether it belonged to the first state or the excited state. So in that sense, we can say that we can answer the question affirmatively. The particle does know its own energy. Now, I want to finish with just one other. That's the main thing I wanted to convey. But I want to finish with a comment about sort of what it's indicating to us and what it has to do with symmetry breaking. So, I mean, one thing that it's indicating to us is that from this point of view, reality has far more detail than what the wave function is giving us. In this case, the wave function, which was just, as it always is in the sum over histories, a set of initial amplitudes, it was just three numbers. Because let's not quibble that the three numbers have an infinite amount of information or something like that. But it was just these three numbers. Whereas corresponding to them, there were 828 co-events, and each one consisted of seven histories, and there's a lot of sort of structure hidden in there, which if you just looked at the wave function, you wouldn't be aware of at all. And this leads to a interesting, sheds an interesting light on the kind of question that's an old question in quantum mechanics. It's raised more recently by Daniel Sudarsky in connection with cosmology, but it goes back to an older question, which is, consider, say, something like the decay of a spinless particle. And then if you look at a wave function that corresponds to the result of that decay, of course, because the particle is spinless, that wave function is spherically symmetric. Now you set up some detectors, or in the old days it was a cloud chamber, and you find, when this was first discussed, and you find that the particle comes out in a particular direction. So how did you get that transition from a spherically symmetric wave function to a particular direction? If this wave function was everything, it looks like it's impossible for that to happen. Well, in this case, we have such a symmetric situation. Let's take the ground state. So the amplitudes were the same. This was the ground state. The amplitudes were the same for every point. And yet corresponding that to that were 828 different co-events, and none of them was spherically symmetric. That, I mean, none of them was invariant under rotation by 2 pi over 3. So if that's the way things are, there's really no mystery. It's just that, the reality itself doesn't share the symmetry that you thought was there, that is there in the initial conditions. The only thing that it's the ensemble of all possible co-events is, of course, rotationally symmetric. But every single one is not. It's perhaps kind of analog of spontaneous symmetry breaking.
So how do you decide which one of those co-events you are in?
Well, how would you decide? So how do you decide classically which world you're in? Yeah. So this is a question of observations and so on. But the theory, it's important to say the theory will not tell you. The theory is just saying, these are the possible realities, just like here are the possible solutions of the classical equations of motion. But then it's up to us to look at certain events and say, did these events happen? Did they not happen? Do measurements, observations. Once you know which events happen, then that narrows down the set of co-events that correspond to it. So I would say it's no different from what happens in classical physics in that respect.
But in classical physics, maybe you specify initial conditions,
If you specify initial conditions, then you can predict, right? So because it's deterministic. But if you take a bigger view, you just have a set of histories. You have a set of rules for which histories are dynamically allowed. And some are and some aren't. And then the theory is silent beyond that. Unless you have a theory of initial conditions, too, which would be maybe some people's ideal. So it would totally specify the reality. Anyway, that was the last slide.
Thank you. a single district.
Right.
Have you any sort of thoughts on
Yes, so of course we don't expect to recover classical physics fully because the world is not classical. But let me say what it would take, just to answer your question as it was asked, let me say what it would take to recover classical physics. So by recovering a classical world, I mean that reality would be described by a single history. That's what I mean, no more and no less. I don't mean recovering Newton's equations or something like this. It's at a logical level recovering classical reality. What it takes is that if the pattern, so let me go back to this, these key concepts, events, co-events, preclusion, and primitivity. Everything, I mean, events and co-events are just definitions, if you like, but all the dynamical information came from the preclusions, and then primitivity was determined on the basis of the pattern of preclusions. So what it takes in order to have classical reality, that all the co-events should be classical, is precisely that the pattern of preclusions be classical. And so what does it mean that the pattern of preclusions is classical? So a classical pattern of preclusions, which means that the A is precluded, so I'll just write it as mu of A equals zero, if and only if A is covered. You can read this. I can't reach high enough to write bigger, by precluded events. It's here where the distinction between the quantum case and the classical case becomes obvious. Because as I said, in these examples of paradoxes like the Koch and Specker paradox, what you have is that the entire history space is covered by precluded events. So from a classical point of view, nothing could happen at all. On the other, so that's the extreme quantum situation. On the other hand, if you have this, that whenever an event is covered by precluded events, so these are the sets of the precluded events, the red ones, let's say. If that implies that this white event here itself is precluded, then I'll say that you have classical pattern of preclusion. And in that case, you can easily prove that reality would be represented by a single history. This, incidentally, it's worth noting that this is the case for classical measure theory. See, one thing I often say in relation to this is that I think from some points of view, it's more natural to think of quantum mechanics as a generalization of a classical probabilistic theory than as a classical deterministic theory. I think many people here might share a similar viewpoint. So if we think in terms of a classical probabilistic theory, then we're talking about a probability measure on the space of histories. And what we're saying is that a set that's covered by sets of measure zero is itself measure zero. That's trivial in the case of a classical measure. But it's false in the quantum case precisely because of interference. So that's what it would take to reproduce a fully classical world. Now, you may also ask what it would take to reproduce sort of classical limit. You know, what we want is that the macroscopic world does behave classically. Not the whole world, but the macroscopic world. So we want something like this to be true when we limit ourselves just to the macroscopic events. And that's another whole story. There's a kind of sufficient condition that I could tell you, but maybe later I can tell you, for what macroscopic events, properties that they must have in order to get a classical world out at the macroscopic level. But the short answer is that everything hinges on the pattern that the preclusions make. No, I wouldn't say, well, first of all, I didn't talk about observations at all, but I would say that our observations do not, I mean, if this is right, then reality cannot be described by a single history.
So, I mean, we have memories and observations of one history.
I would say one coarse-grained history, if you like, perhaps. But even that, you could probably say it like that. What I would say is that our observations represent a set of events, the different events that we found to have happened, and possibly also some other events that we found not to have happened. So the collection of all of that information that we've gathered, I would say, represents our reality. So it's pretty close to what you're saying. If you were to take all the events that we found to happen and intersect them all, that you could call that sort of one coarse-grained event that we found to happen. But there's also the ones we found not to happen. And it's a feature of this, although I didn't stress it or even mention it, that just because an event A does not happen, it does not follow that the event not A happens. Because you could have the event, you could have sort of divide all the events into sort of A and not A, right? If the support of the co-event were like this, overlapping the boundary, then it would, if we asked if A happened, the answer would be no. If we asked whether A not A happened, the answer would be no. And yet if we asked whether A or not A happened, which is anything, did anything at all happen, the answer would be yes. So knowing that certain complementary events happen, or knowing that certain events don't happen, is not equivalent information. So that's why I listed them both together. This is precisely what you would not want. This situation is endemic to the micro world, but this is what you would not want to happen. You would not want the situation if A and not A were instrument events, because our experience is that if we set up some experiment, you know, you get one result or you get the other result. You don't get them both not happening. So from this, in this such a framework, I would say this is the measurement problem. It's to explain why the co-events are such as to not overlap in this way, macroscopically distinct events.
Classical limit, you sort of recover this excluded middle kind of thing.
Yes, yeah. It would be fair to say that that's the ambition. Yes, that if that doesn't happen, then I would say that the proposal fails. I mean, one thing that I should perhaps also stress here is that the reality, that is the support of a co-event, is represented by a set of histories. It corresponds to a set of histories. Superficially, that might sound like many worlds, where again, somehow reality is supposed to be many possible. I don't know what the word to put here, but it might resemble many worlds. But it's actually not supposed to be like that. Precisely for the reason that I said it, because in the many worlds, you have macroscopically distinct outcomes, which are all supposed to happen or not happen or whatever the word, they're all equally real. Here, the only thing that's for sure is that at a microscopic level, you'll have many histories. But what the picture you should have is, if it works, that when you do some sort of experiment and the pointer either goes this way or this way, that the reality consists either of histories that correspond to this pointer reading or histories that correspond to this pointer reading. If it's both, then then it's a failure for the scheme. So microscopically there are this multiplicity. But macroscopically there shouldn't be, because that's not our experience.